Please stay tuned to the end of the episode to hear a promo from our friend Thrasher's podcast that investigates the possibility that serial killers were responsible for a series of unsolved deaths in Ohio in the late 1980s. The podcast is called Lords of Death, and it begins with the story of a double murder in the small town of Byesville. The story is extremely bizarre, and Lords of Death is presented in a way that will hook you on this mystery immediately. Also, if you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There you'll find several different donation tiers, one that includes access to exclusive Gone Cold content. Donors at all levels receive access to regular Gone Cold episodes ad-free. Thanks for the support, y'all. We can't do it without you. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Three kids that never got to experience high school, never got to experience college, never got to experience their first crush, their first anything. They never got to experience life. It's not fair by no stroke of imagination, is it fair?
Lubbock is a city in Texas, just south of the Panhandle. The High Plains City is, perhaps, most known nationally for being the home of musician Charles Hardin Hawley, who you probably know as Buddy, and the 1951 Lubbock Lights phenomenon, a supposed series of UFO sightings, which produced some of the most widely seen V-shaped light pattern photographs, claiming proof of otherworldly visitors. The formation of Lubbock, to simplify, was a result of citizens of both the North and South seeking to explore the South High Plains after the Civil War left many to fall on hard times. The cattle industry was beginning to boom, and many saw the industry and the vast expanse of the plains as an opportunity to get themselves out of the uncertainty that the war had left behind. While there were difficulties taming this last frontier, it worked. And in 1876, Lubbock County was formed, and the city of Lubbock began about 15 years later. The city's population stayed extremely modest for years until in 1909, the railroad arrived. Texas Technical College was founded 12 years later, boasting the most comprehensive education system in the western half of the state, and spiked the city's population even more. The school is now known as Texas Tech University. Lubbock would begin to be known also by its nickname, Hub City, due to the hospital and university systems, as well as its economic opportunities and stronghold over the surrounding rural towns and counties in the South High Plains region. By 2004, Lubbock's population had grown to approximately 211,000. Crime was never an obscurity in Lubbock, but by 2004, the city had seen at least a decade of high violent crime rates. Not only high for Texas, but for the entire United States. The clearance rate for violent crimes, including homicide, is unusually high for the state of Texas in Lubbock, much to the credit of the city's law enforcement officers. But the perpetrator of four of Lubbock's most horrific and unfathomable slayings has remained a mystery since 2004. It remains, in fact, Lubbock's only active case that involves four victims. This story was somewhat outside of what you may have come to expect from Gone Cold. The information available is scant, and although we attempted to gain access and understanding of every single detail, most have been kept out of the public, shrouding the event in mystery and speculation as to what occurred. We approached the Lubbock Police Department for a statement, but they did not wish to speak with us. We approached neighbors and friends and acquaintances of the victims, but they also did not want to share their accounts. In the end, we were only able to speak with two family members. After speaking with them, though, telling the story became immensely important to us. Though this case is touched on every few years in the Lubbock Avalanche Journal newspaper around the anniversary of the quadruple homicide, the family feels that their loved ones have been forgotten. On Monday, October 25th, 2004, between 7:30 and 7:45 a.m., a friend of Tammy Anita Cooper, 45 years old, arrived at her doorstep at the Windcrest Estacado apartment complex on North Martin Luther King Boulevard. The friend was to pick up Tammy's children, 9-year-old twins Kashim and Cadiz, and 11-year-old Mahogany, usually called by her middle name Jasmine, and take them to school. As he raised his hand up to knock, Tammy's friend realized that the door was ajar. He pushed the door open to enter, but froze as his eyes fixed on one of the twins lying motionless on the floor. Blood puddled around him. Tammy's friend quickly called police. Detective Ray Martinez was among the first on the scene. The seasoned homicide detective was aghast at what his eyes beheld. The bodies of Kashim and Cadiz, Jasmine, and their mother Tammy were scattered in multiple rooms in the four-bedroom apartment, the kitchen, living room, and one of the bedrooms. The nature of the attack was brutal and vicious, seemingly inhuman. Blood was everywhere, the walls spattered, and the floors soaked. Furniture was turned over and broken, and though some neighbors would later report a quiet night that night, the signs that this struggle was anything but were everywhere. Virtually the entire apartment was affected by the violent and intense struggle. The police told the press that Tammy had certainly attempted to protect her children from the violence with every fiber of her being, and it appeared that the children were also unyielding in the struggle for their own lives and the life of their mother. Detective Martinez called the homicides of Tammy Cooper and her children a massacre and was quoted by the Lubbock Avalanche Journal as saying that stepping foot into the crime scene was like walking into a nightmare. The press never reported specific details of the cause of the death of Jasmine, Cadiz, Kashim, and Tammy. After the autopsies were performed, police would only say that the family died of multiple injuries due to blunt force trauma, slashing with a sharp instrument, and stabbing with a sharp instrument. Police believe that nothing had been taken from the apartment, but at least one of the murder weapons, a knife, is thought to have come from the Cooper home. Investigators quickly found a friend of Tammy's who had spoken with her on the night of October 24th, the night prior to the bodies of the family being found. She reported to police that while she was talking to Tammy, one of the children answered a knock on the door. The friend told police that the man had a deep voice and was clearly agitated, telling Tammy, "Get off the phone. We need to talk." "How did you find me?" Tammy asked the man. "How did you know I was here?" It was obvious she knew him. This interaction took place between 10:15 p.m. and 11:15 p.m., and it is difficult to nail down anything more exact as the press had reported several conflicting times. There are concerns regarding the call. Either police didn't want certain details released, or the press neglected to ask questions that seem obvious. The friend told police that Tammy's voice did not sound as though she expected trouble of any kind, specifying that Tammy didn't ask her to call 911 or ask for any other kind of help. Tammy told her friend that the man's name was Butch, and that she wouldn't know him because he wasn't from around there. But Tammy also specified that he was black. Oddly, this detail didn't seem to be scrutinized much by police or the press. While we cannot presume to know the context in which Tammy provided this detail to her friend, it seems like a peculiar one for her to have mentioned, and it does raise questions. Was Tammy purposely remaining calm as to not alarm her children? Did Tammy mention Butch's race, hoping her friend would pick up on the subtle cue that she was, indeed, providing a description so that her friend might alert police, and to not alert Butch that she was making a plea for help? Sometime shortly after, another friend would attempt to phone Tammy, but the call went straight to voicemail. Though Tammy Cooper was described by her mother in the press, and by her brothers to us, as social and outgoing, she was also private and kept much of her personal life to herself. Wayne Cooper, Tammy's brother, told us that she was that way in many aspects of her life, but she was close to her mother and brothers. Not only did this present investigators with a difficult hurdle, it allowed conclusions to be made by the press and the public, and perhaps the family, that are groundless in their lack of evidence, but necessary to consider. Speculation on Tammy's reserved personality has led many to wonder if an abusive ex-love interest that no one is aware of committed the homicides of the family of four. It has been implied more than once by news reports that Tammy may have been involved in criminal activity that led to her and her children's deaths, though, again, no evidence of this theory exists. And Wayne told us that his beloved sister never acted as though she had something dubious to hide, although the police relentlessly questioned members of the family about the theory.
There's been rumors that supposedly she was high from somebody, she done stole some money from somebody. I have no idea of anything about her life after she moved up to Lubbock except for what she told me. But like I say, there were no telltale signs that something was wrong, you know, because she had been down here the whole summer in 2004 and had just went back to Lubbock. She stayed down here a whole summer with me and my mom, just spending time with my mom and stuff. So that she, if it was anything that she was hiding, she never let on to anything that something was wrong and that she was in trouble, something of that nature. It was no hints, it was no signs, it was nothing that would lead us to believe that something was wrong with her. She was all smiles and everybody was happy. But I only heard that day after when the detectives came down here. This Butch has been coming up. But I don't know who this guy is. But I've never met this Butch. My mom's never met him. My brother's never met him. So it had to be an association that she either had started before she moved away from Dallas or after she got to Lubbock. But either way, there was no, like I say, when she came down here, we would go out, go to the club, dance a little bit, this, that, the other, and she would be at peace and content. There wasn't no looking over her shoulder or nothing or anything to say somebody's feeling this type of way about me and I'm scared for my life if I'm in fear for my life. Nothing to that effect. So this guy named Butch, he came up in the detective's mouth and everything else, and for the longest, that was their person of interest, and they said they're going to try to find this, that, and that, but nothing happened.
Tammy's mother, Mary, also told the press that if Tammy knew someone was seeking to cause her harm, she would have known, as they had a close relationship. Sergeant Jim Pawhall of the Lubbock Police told the press, "There's a ton of evidence, but there's nothing that links that evidence to a suspect." Tammy, Cadiz, Kashim, and Jasmine had just arrived back in Lubbock in late August so that the children could register for school. They had spent the entire summer in Dallas, staying with family, where they'd lived prior to moving to Lubbock. Since the family had only moved to Lubbock about a year earlier for a fresh start, and police were unable to find any individuals that had motive to cause Tammy harm there, police were certain that Dallas held the key to the mystery of the identity of Butch, and detectives spent ample time in Dallas attempting to eke out leads. The family knew of many of Tammy's love interests, but only one several years in the past that had been particularly volatile. When physical violence against Tammy did surface in that relationship, Wayne Cooper told us, the family intervened and the relationship ended. Strangely, though, this individual attended the funerals of Jasmine, Kashim, Cadiz, and Tammy, staying in the foyer of the church in which they were held, watching only from the monitor there. It's normal in such cases for police to vet those closest to the victim, or victims in this case, and, of course, both Tammy's ex-husband and the father of her children were scrutinized but are not thought to have ever been suspects. According to Wayne Cooper, the father of Cadiz, Kashim, and Jasmine was always a part of their lives and a supportive, nurturing father who got along well with Tammy even after their relationship had ended. It is unlikely, anyway, that Tammy would have asked him, "How did you find me?" if he had been the one to arrive at her apartment the night of October 24th, as he remained close to the rest of the Cooper family. Police weren't the only ones seeking answers in Dallas. Both Wayne and Haskell, one of Tammy's other brothers, continually asked around about the homicides of their sister and niece and nephews. An event that happened a few weeks after the murders, while Haskell had been asking around at the request of police, has always had the family wondering of a connection.
When the detectives were having me and my brother go around and ask questions, my brother was actually, this can't be no coincidence, he was walking down the street and a car was parked down at the end of the street and had his lights off. And as he was walking, the car turned his lights on and sped toward him and fired a shot at him, and he threw his hand up, his arm up in front of his face, and he had a bullet lodged in his arm since 2004. It's that came out of the arm now, but we've always thought that somebody, he got too close to somebody and they wanted to get rid of him before he could put two and two together.
Lubbock detectives exhausted what few leads they had, even one that took them to California. Tammy's mother died last year, never knowing what happened to Kashim, Cadiz, Jasmine, and her daughter, all of whom she referred to as her babies. She was never the same after their murders, Wayne Cooper told us, and neither was he. His sister, his niece, and his nephews were shining lights in his life, and without them, without justice for them, he feels lost and hopeless.
I know that this took more of a toll on my mom than anything because she changed. She had two strokes in this direction, and finally a heart attack killed her. All she used to say is, my baby was here. If my baby was here, if my baby was here. The family dynamic, it changed. It's like the majority of us, we secluded ourselves away from the rest of it. It's like we don't have the bond that we had. And it's like each one of us has a certain buildup of anger that we know it's there. We know the reason why it's there is just there's no way at this particular point for us to find any closure because they still out there. They still walking free. They still have their lives, and they moved on with their lives, and they took four lives that weren't theirs to take. And it's haunting because this time of year, like I say, my sister's birthday was the 1st of October. She was murdered on the 25th of October. My twin nephew's birthdays were the 5th of November. They buried him on the 2nd of November. My niece, her birthday is Christmas Eve. So for the longest, I didn't even celebrate Christmas because I thought that it would be celebrated out there. So I've patched my life up as best as I can. My wife, she's right there beside me, and she didn't even know my sister, but it's like it affected her too to know this, what went on, that nobody has attempted anything after all these years. Nobody has found anybody, and I don't see how that could be when you find people every day. I mean, there's science, there's people that this is what they do on a daily basis, find people that do these horrible acts, commit these horrible acts against society. They find these people. There hasn't even been a slap on the hand of nobody in custody that I know of to point the finger at to be held accountable for this deceitful act. It's just me and my big brother now, and doesn't really talk about it, but it affected him. And now that we lost our mom, we sit up and talk sometimes, and we tell each other, Mama lost a chunk of her life because my oldest sister died 6 months before Tammy and them got killed. Basically, all that pressure was thrown on my mom, and she didn't know how to deal with it. And here we are mourning the loss of my mom. And at the same breath, we're still in mourning over my sister and her kids. And we have no semblance of closure on anything. So the wound is still open in our hearts and in our minds. When it first happened, I had the worst mentality towards whatever, if they found them. I didn't care what bailiff, what judge, what whatever. I told my mom, I said, there's nothing going to stop me from coming across that balance to when they get them in court. to doing something to them. I've since changed it. I just want them to be found, held accountable, and then for the rest of their lives, they have to know that they took a chunk of my family out. There's three kids that never got to experience high school, never got to experience college, never got to experience their first crush, their first anything. They never got to experience life. And it's not fair by no stroke of imagination. Is it fair for them to be still walking free, carrying their lives on, and our lives are stuck in quicksand because we can't move forward because there's no anything to move forward on. We can take a step, but we still are carrying these weights on. So the potential that we can move that our lives that could be is being held back because we still carrying all this weight on our shoulders, not knowing who did it, not knowing what happened, anything.
On November 2, 2004, at the Cornerstone Baptist Church in Dallas, Reverend John Williams eulogized 11-year-old Jasmine, 9-year-olds Kashim and Cadiz, and 45-year-old Tammy Cooper before pallbearers carried each casket to its own white hearse. Reverend Williams was the pastor of Wesley Memorial in Lubbock. He spoke of the children, how kind, thoughtful, respectful, and joyous they were when he saw them on Sundays, picking them up to attend services at his church. They were buried in Lincoln Memorial Park in Dallas.
You see it on the news. You see these families being torn apart. But then when it hits in your house, it hit close to home, and it just, this ain't happening. This can't be. And it's like, every year, no matter what, how it goes down, from the end of September all the way to the first of the year, I go into an agitated, depressed state of mind. And it's like, I'm still doing that 13 years later. Something's got to give. Something has to come through to give somebody some closure in this situation, because a guy brought me an article that they was in the newspaper talking about the murders. And he knew, you know what I'm saying, about it, because October and November, and I'm going through, you know. And, man, ain't this about your sister, man? And he brought me the newspaper, and I was like, yeah. I ran across one of the newspaper articles from the day of the funeral when my mom passed out in me and my nephew's arms, crying. And it just all brought everything just right back. I got all the kids' pictures. I got everything. I got my pictures of my sister. And it's like, when I see this smile and the light in these kids and in my sister's eyes, it don't say nothing about I'm in trouble. It don't say nothing about somebody's after me. It don't say nothing about I'm in fear for my life. None of this comes to mind when you look at these pictures and you think of the times that y'all done spent together. Nothing comes to mind that this woman would have an enemy to the point where they would take her life. It's still not registering, you know, that, and why. And I don't question God, you know. He called them home, as they say. But I expected to call them to be called home by natural causes, not by the hand of another man. So it's refreshing, and it's painful at the same time, because to be able to get all this into words and somebody use it for the good of trying to help my sister and her kids out, I can breathe easy knowing that somebody out there cares enough to do what others want. I pray that it never went to a cold case, and that subsequently seems like what it did, because nobody except you guys has even remotely tried to contact the family and find out anything going on. Do we have any clues or any new information or anything? It's like it never happened. Around here, people talk to us and they say, you know, oh, I didn't even know your sister them got killed. They ask about my sister. I didn't know she got killed. Or they'll say, you know, man, I'm sorry what happened to your sister, things of that nature, but no one goes any further. It's basically tight-lipped. No, I mean, it's like out of sight, out of mind, it's gone. It's done. they ain't coming back. We ain't nobody, you know, say coming forward. Ain't nobody this, that, and other. Get on with your life.
If you have any information on the murders of Tammy Cooper and Cadiz Kashim and Mahogany Jasmine Allen, please contact the Lubbock Police Department at 806-775-2865 or the Crime Line at 806-741-1000. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, Christina will bring you the stories of Taliba Islam and Tiffany Johnson, and the family's continuous search for answers. We would like to offer our sincerest thanks to Wayne and Haskell Cooper for their willingness to share and for their contributions to this episode. We'd also like to thank Kim Smith for her help in researching the Cooper Allen case. The Lubbock Avalanche Journal was used as a source for this episode. You can contact Gone Cold Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching Gone Cold Podcast. Be sure to join our Facebook discussion group for posts about the cases we cover, among others. It's an incredible group of folks gathered there, and we'd love to have more of you. Also, check out thetruecrimefiles.com. It's an excellent site doing excellent work. Thetruecrimefiles.com is our go-to resource on the web for all things true crime. Now for a promo of Lords of Death, an amazing podcast from our friend Thrasher Banks. You're going to love it. Thanks for listening, y'all.
People like that, you know, are capable of doing anything. And that's where the fear comes in.
A man put a screwdriver through the skull and no lady would kill anybody. So I think everybody was scared to death. A small little town.
I'm convinced that we were living with a serial killer.
When two people kill together, they form an unbreakable bond. It's said to prove your loyalty and become a Lord of Death, you have to take a soul and make the ultimate sacrifice. Lords of Death is the story of two serial killers, the people who let them get away, and the one person who never stopped pursuing the truth. Dayton, Ohio, I'm Thrasher Banks. Lords of Death is available now on Apple Podcasts.